Today, you could probably put what I have to say under the category of bad news, and tomorrow under the category of good news. I want this morning to develop a way of looking at this strange development in American culture, and indeed in the West, and try to make sense of it, to try and put categories on it, names. It's no use saying, isn't it awful? We need to be able to identify the nature of the enemy by usable categories, and that's what I want to do this morning. I'm going to give a sort of an overview in the first lecture, and then in the second lecture, with the help of PowerPoint, I want to give a more coherent expose of this new spirituality that has entered the West, so that you can go away from here saying, I know exactly what that is that's happening in our culture today, and we have the answer to it. Because tomorrow I want to talk about the answer, the biblical response to this massive challenge in our time. I know we've all been caught by surprise by what is happening in our culture today. I first came over to the United States in 1964. I had lots of blonde hair at the time. You wouldn't have recognized me. And I discovered American culture in a way that I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. Christianity was so powerful in all the areas of life. People were honest and moral. And I was quite amazed coming from Europe, which for many you could describe as godless, as it had developed. And I studied here in some conservative and then even liberal schools. And then the Lord called me to teach in France. Now there is a godless culture. And for 18 years I labored in a place where it was socially unacceptable to even raise the subject of spirituality. The French are rationalists, secularists, and they don't want anything to do with spirituality. So there was this big gap between what I was doing in France and what I'd seen in America. And I came back to America on the call of the Lord to teach here in 91. And I thought I'd died and gone to hell. The difference was enormous. What was odd, though, America's always been very spiritual. And what I saw, I went through culture shock. What I saw was actually a change in spirituality. That America had not become a secular humanist country like France, but it was becoming a very spiritual culture, but a spirituality that was profoundly antagonistic to the Christian faith. And I struggled to ask myself, how is this possible in the very fortress of Christianity in the modern world that could develop such a noxious form of unbelief and opposition to the Christian faith that was incubating in this very fortress of Christian America? You all feel that. You've all seen that. And I started writing books about it and trying to think about how you could get in your head what was happening. Instead of just seeing, isn't it awful over here? Isn't it terrible there? What are we going to do about this problem? And I began to think that really the problem was of a much more general nature, and that all these weird things that were happening in the culture could be reduced to one fundamental motivation, one fundamental way of thinking. So that's what I want to do this morning, is give you some sense of what that thinking is, so that as you are in this society and you meet people who have bought into this way of thinking, you all know the classic phrase by now, I'm spiritual but not religious. You've heard that? Is anybody out there? Okay, it's just these lights are shining and I can't see anybody, and then I couldn't hear anybody, so I didn't know if you were there. Spiritual but not religious. It sounds great, but you know what it means? Spiritual means I've rejected Christianity, which is the religion. So if you rejected religion, which is essentially in America the Christian religion, then what is the spirituality that you boast about? Isn't that a good question? And that's where we need to focus. Now, one of the things that gets our attention right now is gay marriage. Albert Mola, I don't know whether he's spoken here. If he hasn't, he should. He said, we've got to start talking about this subject because we are going to find ourselves on the wrong side of the law. Do we Christians know how to relate to this subject? What is the meaning of it? And, you know, it's a very awkward subject because as soon as you open your mouth, you are accused of homophobia. Now, this is a totally unjust accusation. Here's what phobia means in the dictionary. An anxiety disorder characterized by extreme and irrational fear of things or social institutions. Or an abnormal, intense, and irrational fear of a given situation. So we're being told that this normative way of looking at sexuality that has marked America since its founding, and indeed marked the whole of Western civilization for 2,000 years, is irrational fear. Well, that's obviously not the case. But there's something going on, you see, in the refusal to actually look at the issues and to really intimidate you to silence by accusing you of phobia. And it seems to me that this notion of sexuality actually, and not many people are saying this because it's politically incorrect, actually brings us to the heart of the spirituality that I'm trying to define for you. It is indeed the embodiment, the sexual embodiment of a certain kind of spirituality that is antithetical to biblical spirituality. Do you understand that? Now, I'm not saying that every homosexual or lesbian or whatever have gone through some kind of spiritual thinking. So I don't want you to take it as a blanket statement about every individual homosexual. I'm just saying that this arises out of a particular kind of spirituality. That it is the embodiment of a timeless religious view that has been known throughout the world, and sometimes we call it paganism. I want to give you something very simple, though, to grab hold of. You know, the Apostle Paul is amazingly dense, and as you read him, you realize that you're in the presence of an intellectual genius. He was. But he also had the ability of making things extremely simple and clear. And for this particular issue of what is happening today in our world, Paul's statement in Romans chapter 1, verse 25, is of enormous help and importance. You know what Paul says in this verse? That there are only two ways of being a human being in the world. Only two ways. Now, you've heard there are 365 different ways of being religious and so on. Paul says there are only two. Remember what that verse says? He says you either worship the creation or you worship the Creator. There are no other options. And you say, well, what about those people who don't worship? There's nobody who doesn't worship. Even atheists worship themselves. They actually worship themselves, thus a form of the creation. So Paul is dead on when he gives us these two categories of ways of thinking about the world. Is that simple or not? Only two ways. You either worship creation or you worship the God who made the creation. I think that is mind-blowingly simple and beautiful. And as I've thought about this text, and I wrote a book about it, about one verse, and it's on the back table called One or Two, and there are only 30 copies, so you folks this morning might be fortunate if you pick one up, because for the rest of the weekend there won't be any. And there's also a little, what I call an evangelism tool, and you can take one of those free with you. So only just take one so that everybody can get one. That's at the back table. And what that book and what that evangelism tool talks about in slightly different terminology is this notion of two options. There are only two ways of being in the world. And I tried to develop a simple way of describing those things. And here it is. Either it's one-ism or two-ism. Now, if you can count from one to two, you can be a theologian. Isn't that good news? One-ism, you see, means that the creation exists and there's nothing else, so that everything in the creation shares the same nature. So it's all one. And you've heard Al Gore saying forever, all is one. And so many of our pop stars and everything else are into this ideology of all is one. So when I use the term oneism, I'm not inventing something that is not out there. It's out there all the time. So think of what's happening in this new spirituality as oneism, as a turning away from the other notion of the Bible, which is twoism. Now, why would you use the term twoism? Well, twoism, I tried to create a term that expresses the notion that really in existence, there are two kinds of beings. There is the Creator, who is eternal, and then there's everything else, which is creation, which has a beginning. So God has no beginning, and everything else does. That's why, by the way, if someone comes to you and says, I have a secret I want to share with you, you can become divine. Well, unfortunately, you can't, you see, because if to be divine is to have no beginning, then you have a bad beginning in the career of being God, because you lose right away. Only God has no beginning, is eternal. So you see, there are two kinds of being. There's God the Creator on the one hand, and then everything else is creation. And you see, that's the essence of our Christian faith. Because the Bible begins off in Genesis, the first line, in the beginning, God, right, created the heavens and the earth. So you have God who exists alone, but not quite alone. It's the Trinitarian God who exists in all eternity. And then he creates everything else. You see, that opening statement of the Bible is a twoist statement. Do you follow me? It is a twoist statement. And I like to say, really, that everything else from that opening line in the Bible is commentary. That's where we begin to understand what the Bible is saying to us. And it develops, of course, in wonderful ways. And the God who is other than us becomes part of us in the humiliation of the Son, in the incarnation. So the God who creates us becomes our Redeemer. And that's the wonderful story. But that story of redemption, you see, cannot be understood without understanding the story of creation and the story of twoism. The gospel depends upon people understanding twoism, that there is a God outside of us who cannot be reduced to us, who nevertheless in condescension comes to save us. And the trouble with this growth of this oneism in our world is that it's closing the minds of people to hear what? The gospel. So if what I'm saying to you sounds rather theoretical, it really has as a final implication the desire to want to silence the twoist gospel of the Bible. And I think when you understand that, you begin to understand what is happening in our world today. You know, for our young people, it's very tough because they were born into this particular situation of cultural implosion. People like myself, and there are a number of you here around my age, we saw a different kind of culture as we were growing up. When I was growing up with John Lennon, we were in a state school, but we actually started every day with a hymn and a prayer. Think about that. It was just normative to have people trained to think in twoistic ways, even if they were not believers. It was just the nature of the world. There's been a drastic, radical change in the way in our culture we describe existence. And a famous historian, Elizabeth Fox Genovese, an amazing woman, she had a PhD from Harvard, was a Marxist feminist and was part of the 60s revolution. But towards the end of her life, she became a Christian. And she wrote in her book this amazing statement: within a remarkably brief period has occurred a cataclysmic transformation of the very nature of our society. A cataclysmic transformation. I don't think you can understand the present time without knowing that. And so I go around America and the world really talking to young people and trying to give them some sense of what has occurred to make the world that they think is a normal world understandable in terms of this fundamental commitment of worldview. So here's the proof, it seems to me, from an American historian that in a remarkably brief period has occurred a cataclysmic transformation of the very nature, the very essence of our society. What possibly could do that except some kind of spiritual revolution, right? The very nature of a society means the society has been changing in the way it conceives of everything and thus is a very spiritual way of looking at things. In the second lecture this morning, I want to give you a sense of what this oneism is. In this lecture, I want to show you that not only is this way of thinking being promoted as the only possible way forward, but that there is a secondary agenda, which is the attempt to eliminate twoism. To eliminate twoism. You see, if you want to build a new society based on oneism, then you cannot allow this other notion, this fundamentally different notion of twoism to have a place. You will always be obstructed from creating this perfectly oneist world. And that's why I believe what we're seeing in particular in the homosexual movement is this intention to silence the Christian voice. It's not just, you see, on a moral level that this is going on. but it's going on at an even deeper level of spirituality. That, the, as Paul calls it, the lie cannot abide the truth. So that the truth, Paul calls this, you remember, they exchanged the truth for the lie and worshipped and served the creation rather than the creator. We're dealing here with elemental issues of truth and the lie. And when you put them face to face, they eliminate each other. And those that are now proposing this worship of the creation, the lie, are hell-bent on silencing the message and the worldview of truism. That's what's happening. Does that make sense? You see, and it makes sense simply in this way, that that particular way of describing things is capable then of accounting not just for homosexuality, but for all the other things that are taking place. So that our discourse on homosexuality as such, get this, doesn't have to be moralistic. You follow what I'm saying with that? When we talk about these things, we can fall into the trap of sounding moralistic. You know, I'm better than you are, you're a sinner, I'm not, God hates fags, all that kind of an approach. I'm suggesting to you that the way of processing what's happening, in particular in this extremely debated issue of homosexuality, that really we need the distance of what I call a cosmology, a view of everything, a view of the world. And when you can put it in those terms, you see, it de-dramatizes the accusation of hate, because really we're talking about the very nature of existence, not just focusing on one particular group as sinners. So I'm going to talk this morning, if I ever get to my lecture. You see, I haven't begun my lecture yet. On the attempts in the present-day culture to destroy the binary. The binary. I've been seeing this term showing up in all kinds of literature. And of course, it's really not developed the way I've just explained it as a theological category that goes right back to Paul. But the binary means truism. And that there is a concerted effort to destroy the binary in the way people act and think. And I want to give you a few examples of that just to indicate, you see, how this explains what's happening. There are all kinds of areas where this is able to be identified. This, I believe, is where we need to situate the debate about homosexuality and same-sex marriage, because it is part of a oneist worldview. So this worldview that claims to describe everything, you see, must eliminate the opposing worldview. That's what's happening. So you could say that what I'm going to describe is binary busting. The removal of the categories of two, of distinction. Now that category is important because God created the world that way. You see, God made a twoist world. He separated things out, day and night, light and darkness, dry land and the waters, male and female. That's all in just the first chapter of the Bible, by the way. God creates a world of truism, of distinctions, valid, both distinctions are valid. And I believe God does it that way to reflect this ultimate distinction between the world and himself. So that as we engage in our life in accepting the nature of the world as he's made it, we're actually expressing the very nature of God's creation. And so, needless to say, those who want to reject that worldview will want to silence that message and eliminate the distinctions. And that obviously is the case in homosexuality, where the distinction of male and female is obliterated. So let's look at a few areas. What time do I end? 10:30, okay. Let's look at a few areas where there is a concerted effort to eliminate the binary in the area of morals. We hate to make moral judgments anymore. We hate to use the word evil. The great psychologist Carl Jung, who is a great influence on our modern world, said, "We must beware of thinking of good and evil as absolute opposites." That's the way many people are now being raised, you see. Good and evil are really only perspectives. And there is no real distinction, no moral binary that really will finally hem us in to certain kinds of decisions. And so this coming oneist world is based on a total relativization of good and evil. People don't like being obstructed in the expression of themselves by this binary notion of good and evil. You can show this in many ways, and I don't have time to do it, but keep your eye open for this refusal to affirm genuine evil and just simply see it, people wanting to just see everything in a very blurred kind of way. You see it in this new spirituality, in the removal of the notion of truth and error, of how we think in a twoist way. Because this spirituality really is based upon the elimination of the mind. And of course, the mind is a distinction-making factory. Every word I say, hopefully, is different from any other word. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to follow what I'm saying, right? So I'm making distinctions as I'm using language. Language is a twoist phenomenon. How interesting. The essence of this new spirituality we see growing in America actually has as a fundamental principle what the Eastern mystics have always said, which I quote, "We must consciously destroy the mind. Keep your intellect at a respectable distance. That which separates you from God is mind." So we have here, you see, a rejection, really, of a rational view of existence. In psychology, another way of getting rid of the binary is to get people to come to an understanding of the good and evil urges in themselves as the light and dark side of their being, and that healing is the success of actually rising above good and evil. Indeed, you see, if success is what they want, the success is the elimination of the notion of guilt. So you can be a psychologically whole person in this new way of conceiving of psychology as you are taught, as you learn to relativize the dark and the light side within you. This, by the way, was also what Carl Jung said, which was celebrated, obviously, in Star Wars, the light side and the dark side. And the whole goal of that movie is to balance the two. And that's what we now describe as psychological wholeness, you see, is to relativize these two sides of us so that we can be free of guilt. I suppose you can see it in politics as we move towards a more and more powerful state. The totalitarian state, says a philosopher, aims at obliterating all distinctions between itself and the citizenry by penetrating and controlling every aspect of organized life. In other words, we must beware of this move towards a statist view of existence. And of course, that's happening in the area of marriage, by the way, as the state is coming along, or it will come along, to redefine marriage. And so the state becomes the source of our definitions of something as fundamental as marriage. And of course, marriage existed long before the state. But this whole process, you see, is part of a new view of existence in this sort of collectivist way of thinking. Whereas the Constitution, I think, is a thoroughly twoist document, establishing the notion that all our rights come from the Creator, which is a two-ish notion, of course. But this movement, which is spiritual, is also political, and their intention is to change the Constitution. They have to. They realize that the Constitution is a two-ish document, you see. And so don't be surprised if in the days ahead we have a movement that way. We already have it in many ways. One of the most clear examples of the destruction of the binary is happening in the whole area of spirituality. If you're a reader and you enjoy this kind of morbid thinking like I do, you should read a book that is very illustrative of what I'm saying. Written by a man who clearly was raised as a Jew, Philip Goldberg, who wrote the book in 2010, American Veda. American Veda. And this scholar actually shows that America has, in a massive way, bought into Eastern Hinduism, into Hinduism of various kinds. And we all know this. Terms like avatar and karma and mantra and yoga, which is now practiced by 18 million Americans. It's like if you went to the East and people were getting baptized. It's the same kind of phenomenon. And you'd say, oh, there's a spiritual revolution going on in the East. People are getting baptized, 18 million in one country. You can imagine what the Hindus think as they see 18 million Americans practicing yoga. So these terms are on our lips every day, and we don't realize what they mean. But, for instance, yoga is in Sanskrit means union of the self with God. Now, it's not the God of the Bible. It's not the God of twoism. It's the God of oneism that is the goal of this union. So, why is it that the Dalai Lama can speak to thousands? Just recently in San Diego, at the various universities there, but Ossie Sproul and Al Mohler and Tim Keller never get invited. Because our culture is really reaching out to this kind of thinking and suppressing its historic notions of Christianity. Of course, one of the reasons is this Hindu spirituality from the East claims to be non-dogmatic. You see, that it's open to every particular way of thinking. And so to go that way is to be an extremely tolerant person. Whereas we can see that the Christians are totally intolerant and they will not open their minds to other things. So this kind of ideology fits very well with a certain form of thinking in our culture. So you have the spirituality that comes in and says, you know, all is one, God is in everybody, and so we can tolerate everybody and appreciate everybody. It sounds attractive to many people who don't really know much about spirituality or theology. But in terms of the destruction of the binary, this is not non-dogmatic. It's as dogmatic as any Christian preacher, because it will not abide the notion of the binary. Is it that tolerant? Not at all. It is intolerant of the binary. And here's the proof. This Philip Goldberg comes to a certain point in his book and tries to describe what the essence of this kind of thinking is. And he gives a Hindu Sanskrit word that I have found all over the literature today. And it's the term Advaita. Advaita. A-D-V-A-I-T-A. And he says this is the essence of this spirituality that's come from the East and is now taking over the West. I was amazed to understand what that Sanskrit word means. Does anybody know what it means? It means not to. Isn't that amazing? This is a fundamentally anti-biblical notion that is inspiring people into spirituality, which has as its very goal the absolute elimination of a twoist binary worldview. That is the most intolerant expression that you can find. And it is going on apace. Advaita. A-D-V-A-I-T-A. Keep your eye open for that. It is the battering ram against the Christian faith. And the great goal, you see, is a non-dual integration of everything. Non-dual, not two. They accuse Christians of this duality, of trying to separate things out. Whereas we know the goal is to bring all things to one. This is the powerful subterranean and not so subterranean message through these notions of spirituality. You know why it's difficult sometimes to share the gospel with some of your friends? They bought into this stuff without realizing it. This is the way they're beginning to see the world. That's why I wrote that little evangelism tool to help you to meet this kind of thinking and help people to see that what they're now believing is not neutral or without or not intolerant, but is a very intolerant way of conceiving of existence. It's the other way of thinking, as the Bible describes things. The Advaita, says Goldberg, is the West's spiritual destiny. And so you have another attempt at the destruction of the binary in interfaith, where Christian churches, some of them, are now joining with all the religions, essentially saying, you see, that there is no spiritual binary, that all the religions are the same. And how many people do you know that have been caught in that kind of thinking? And you see, as churches and denominations buy into this kind of thing, as Dr. Larson said yesterday, the gospel all of a sudden loses any of its force. How can you preach the gospel to somebody in another religion if you've already told them that all the religions are the same? And so the first thing that goes is the uniqueness of Jesus and the truth of the gospel. It's being removed out of eschatology or end times in the denial of heaven and hell. That's the ultimate binary in a sense, isn't it? It's the judgment of God that will be applied. And there are two ultimate places to which the world and its inhabitants will go. How many people have rejected the notions of heaven and hell that you know? You see, this rejection of the binary goes absolutely everywhere in our culture. But as I indicated at the beginning, we see it more profoundly in areas of sexuality. I'll begin this by talking about the elimination of the gender binary. I'm always amazed to realize that the Bible begins off in the first chapter by telling us about the image of God. And it says God made man in his image, male and female. There is here, at the very beginning of the Bible story, this distinction between male and female. And in our culture, in the last generation or so, we have seen a massive attempt to eliminate gender distinctions, that is, roles between males and females. In the name of American democracy, we have erased as much as we can, and we'll keep doing it, the distinctions between males and females. And we have changed our world in radical ways by doing that. And one of the things we've done by this whole gender egalitarianism is to set up our world for the dismissal of any significance to gender, to sexual distinctions. And so that opens the door for homosexuality and various expressions of it. Oberlin College, is that anywhere near here, Bruce? Huh? Ohio. That's not Iowa. Huh? No. You know, I got on the plane yesterday to come here. I didn't know where I was going. I was just following Bruce's instructions. Get on this plane, then another one, and you will be where you're going. So I confuse some of these places. But Oberlin College, which was founded by two Presbyterian ministers and was headed as its second president by Charles Finney, describes where they are in sexuality. Particular transgenderism is the transgressing of gender norms, finding a space that combines or defies the binary in our society. And so there is an attempt to eliminate the male-female distinction. In 1970, the Gay Revolution Party Manifesto, this is already in 1970, that's 40 years ago. Listen to this quote. The gay revolution will produce a world in which all social relationships will be gay and in which in which homo and heterosexuality will be incomprehensible terms. That was said 40 years ago. Now there is an attempt, you see, to eradicate all gender distinctions from our language. An example, in Sweden, they have changed the pronouns of he, han, and she, han. That's why they call her honey. She, han, to hen. So in Sweden now, you've got rid of male-female pronouns, and you have this indistinguishable pronoun, hen. We are changing some of our documents. M and F are being eliminated from birth certificates, and mother and father also is eliminated, and it's parent A and parent B. So this vision of a genderless society is here, and it's just making its way in more and more ways as we speak. Well, it seems to me that we need to set our thinking about what is happening in the culture regarding the homosexual movement in this much broader canvas of a change of thinking. You see, it's not just gay marriage. If it were that, we'd solve the problem, right? If we were able to eliminate that notion. And of course, I'm not saying we shouldn't be active in politics and preserving the way things are, but I'm just indicating to you that the problem is much greater, much deeper than the way we sometimes tend to think about it, and that, you know, the events around the Chick-fil-A restaurants and so on is wonderful, but it doesn't get to the heart of where this culture is going in its fundamental change of worldview. These kinds of things, you see, are absolutely inevitable. And that means that the only way to speak to it is to speak on this fundamental level of the way God puts the world together. We need to be able to speak into the situation with the truth of twoism. As I said earlier, hopefully this will mean that we can avoid both moralism, the sort of holier-than-thou attitude, and the accusations. We won't avoid this, the accusations of hate. It'll always be called hate because Jesus says they will hate you. But at least we can do it in a way that shows that our agenda is much larger than simply the homosexual movement, and that people are more and more buying into the homosexual movement because their thinking at this much larger and deeper level has already been changed to think this way. Does that make sense? And so it's important for us as Christians, A, to not fall into that kind of thinking, and B, to understand it in order to speak the gospel into it. So that's my burden to you, to bring to you, is this vision of God's world and the fundamental desire of fallen man to change it to something quite different. I want to close with just a word about heterosexuality. The Apostle Paul tells us in Ephesians 5:32 that the male-female relationship actually holds within it a mystery. Paul means by mystery a fundamental truth to be found in God himself that is revealed to the world. And it's interesting, in this text, Paul then cites Genesis 2:24. When did the fall happen? What chapter? Genesis 3. So Paul is citing a pre-fall text. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. A pre-fall text. So when he uses the word mystery, you see, he's not talking, as he often does, about the mystery of the redemption in Christ. He's talking about the mystery of the way the world is put together. And essentially, what he is saying is that heterosexuality, in many ways, can be seen as the key to the cosmos, the key to the way the world is put together. And that's why he can then go on to describe the gospel of Christ's love for the church in these kinds of terms. So that heterosexuality has writing on it, both an understanding of the way the world has been put together by the God of tuism who creates distinction, but also a wonderful expression of the gospel of tuism, that Christ, who is other, who is different than us in his divinity, who comes and is incarnate with us, that Christ loves the church. Now, the church doesn't become Christ, right? The church is in a union with Christ. And that's the expression, the beautiful expression of the gospel. And that's why Paul can pick up that image. It's absolutely essential, you see, that the creation and redemption are held together. They are in a beautiful symphony, and we, in our witness, have to show that. And so the Bible ends with this wonderful call. Well, before I say that, I want to thank the Lord for my, I think it's 40 years of marriage. My wife knows. We've had 7 wonderful children, and we have 12 grandchildren. And I recommend marriage. I recommend it as perhaps the greatest form of sanctification I've ever known. It's a constant struggle to have yourself mirrored, your real self mirrored in the face of your spouse. But, you know, that's the truth about the world, isn't it? It's the other. It's the one who is different than us, who can reflect back to us what we need to see and understand about ourselves. And I think that that is part of the reason why I rejoice in saying that the Bible ends with a marriage, with your marriage to Jesus. The Spirit and the bride say, come. Let him who hears say, come. Whoever is thirsty, let him come. And whoever wishes, let him take the free gift of the water of life. Thank you very much.